Well, I kind of thought you'd still have your Halloween costume on. Apparently not.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I was waiting for you to compliment me on my costume. I'm trying to
look like... Oh, you do have your Halloween costume on. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm disguised as a curmudgeon. No, no.
You're not really disguised. I got news for you.
And how many kids did you have last night, Bob?
Zero.
No, that's not true. You had lots of people walk by and they said, lights are off, no candy.
Well, that's the
truth. Bastard.
Well, there's a big ass
bastard.
There's still a big ass dumpster in the front of my house. I mean, I don't know why the kids would expect. I suspect most of the people in the neighborhood don't know I'm living here yet. They think because of all this renovation is going on that, well, he hasn't moved in yet.
And then the five people that have reported the squatter in the basement.
Well, there were actually no knocks on the door. And I did sneak up to the upstairs and look out the front. And I saw no kids on the street. Uh-huh. So I think it's just, you know, it's my first time here for Halloween. So yeah. You never know, right?
Busiest Halloween in the history of this address.
For really?
Us. Yep.
Yeah. Were you at the door or was your bride at the door?
No, we had a helper.
One of the kids?
Yeah. We had a helper.
So you did what? You just sat in your little space.
I carved the pumpkin. I carved the pumpkins.
You did?
Oh, sure. Sure, I do all of that stuff. I do all of that stuff. I get everything ready. I get the candles lit in the pumpkins. I do all of it.
Well,
I buy the candy. I buy the candy.
Oh, well, good for you. What did you buy? Did you buy something good?
Yes. Mr. Biggs and Coffee Crisps. Full bars. You come to the Shannon house, you get looked after.
Well, if I was going to come to the Shannon house, I sort of would expect filet mignon and baked potato.
You have to be safe. Everything has to be packaged. You know, you can't leave it. It's not like the old days where you'd walk down to Mrs. Miller's house and she'd give you a handful of popcorn, you know?
Oh, well, no, or a little tiny bag with popcorn in it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Things have changed, but no, it was the busiest Halloween, I think, on record in our neighborhood. But what that is, as you know, Bob, is the cycle of young families coming into neighborhoods, right?
Well, there's that. And I think, you know, I suspect how has it been 2 years since we've had or 3 years since we've had actually had Halloween? How many Halloweens did we miss? Just one?
No, we missed October of 20. Yeah, just one. October of 2020.
Oh, okay.
So October, still, yeah, it's been a while. Yeah, no, it was good though. It was good.
Social media indicates that a lot of grown-ups were dressing up on the weekend and going to various parties.
Well,
I do not understand at all.
No, there's two things I don't understand about people dressing up. That's the first one. But the fact that Halloween was on a weekend, you know, almost was licensed to have a Saturday party.
Well, sure,
that you have a costume party, but. The other one is people over the age of 18 wearing a sports jersey with somebody else's name on the back. That's the other one. So,
well, if those ne'er-do-wells came to my door, I would shoo them away.
No, you were shooing everybody away anyway.
With a real shotgun, not a fake one either.
Yeah.
And here's the other thing. You're right. There were boatloads of Halloween parties on Friday night and Saturday night. Even I got invited to some.
Oh.
Not that I went. I went to a party. I did go to a gathering on Saturday night, but I made sure it was not a dress-up Halloween party. And it wasn't, so I was okay to go. But why is Halloween always the last day of the month?
Well,
wouldn't it be better if Halloween was Friday night, the last Friday of every month, or even the last Saturday of every month?
Well,
doesn't that make more sense?
Doesn't it have something to do with All Hallows Eve?
Oh, I don't care. It's not.
You're suggesting that we modernize it and make it more convenient.
Well, for the kiddies.
Yeah, but the fact is that October 31st is October 31st.
Well, I know, but Sunday night, or you know, if it's a week,
I can't believe you're a traditional guy. You're wanting to change the rules now.
No, I want to change the rules.
I don't get it.
I mean, does anybody really care that it's, you know, the historic reference to All Hallows Eve? I don't. I mean, it's not a religious holiday. It is not. I guess there may be a few witches and things who think it's important, but
why do you worry about it? You don't even give out candy.
My kids are gone. You know, they're probably still out trick or treating, but they're grown adults now. They're probably the same ones that came to your door in a Maple Leafs jersey.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, you made it through and so did I.
We all survived.
Bah humbug till next year.
Yeah.
We're going to talk baseball a little bit later on. JP Morosi is going to join us, but I thought we'd chat a little bit about some curious things happening at the beginning of the hockey season. Well, let me not so curious. Both Edmonton and Calgary off to quick starts. Edmonton doesn't surprise me the least, but Calgary does a bit. You?
Oh, well, and not only that, but how they've done it, Bob. They won on a 5-game Eastern road swing and won every game.
Yeah.
Won every game. Jacob Markstrom, who did, let's face it, after signing as a free agent prior to the 56-game schedule and did not help the team get to the playoffs, has been spectacular in what they've done. And they've got a lot of offense from a lot of different places. To me, Calgary is a huge surprise in the NHL right now. And then they come home, and usually what happens if you play Thursday on the road in the Eastern time zone and you fly home and play Saturday, that first game at home is a disaster, an absolute disaster, because you're back with your families, you're tired, time change. Yep. And the Flames went and beat Philadelphia again. So 6 straight victories now for them. And the Oilers and the Flames are atop that Pacific Division right now.
I would say that the Oilers' performance, while admirable, is potentially sustainable. They have the kind of team that you can see that, you know, if they really have gotten it together, they can win consistently. Is Calgary that team? I mean, we're surprised by them. So that implies that we're not sure that they can be this team through 82 games.
Well, but I think we're surprised for a couple of things. First of all, Mark Giordano, their captain, I would argue their best defenseman, gone in the expansion draft and playing very well in Seattle, by the way. And then, you know, you and I talked about this. We talked about it with Brad, that we expected this team to make major overhaul.
And they did
a couple of their superstars, and they didn't. And those guys are contributing. The one thing that is it sustainable, the thing that I would pipe in with is Daryl Sutter will make sure that it's sustainable. And that's the one thing that Daryl Sutter will do. And I think it might be. I think it might be. Now, as long as Markstrom can maintain some of this, you know, he's had 3 shutouts in his last 6, I think. And
yeah,
boy, he has been unbelievable.
Well, you're not going to win if you don't get good goaltending over any extended period of time. That goes without saying. And I think Calgary's in the same boat. I'm quite shocked.
And from the Oiler perspective, the one question mark everyone had was their goaltending. And their bigger question mark within the goaltending was, can Mikko Koskinen have a good year? And Koskinen's played very well. Mike Smith is hurt already. Supposed to be back this week, but Koskinen has made some key saves at key times, and done very well. We know they're going to score goals, Bob. We know they're going to score goals, but can they stop them? And that's been what the Oilers have been able to do too, that at key times they've been able to stop them.
Now, at the other end of the equation, we've yammered a little bit about them over this early part of the season as the Montreal Canadiens, the Stanley Cup finalists from last year. And I'm even hesitant to label them as that, because all it does is emphasize where they are now, and they're a mess.
Yep.
And there's every reason to believe they will be a mess all year.
Don't know how to, I don't know if they know how to get out of it. It's they can't score goals. I think they've played, they're 2-8, and they've only scored 19 goals. So you're not going to win very many hockey games, if any, by scoring less than 2 goals per game. It's not a knock and reflection of Jake Allen, who has tried his hardest in goal. They use Samuel Montembeau yesterday in Anaheim. He wasn't the answer in goal. But they're not getting any goal scoring from guys they expect to take a goal scoring from. Nick Suzuki, Cole Caulfield hasn't scored yet. You have to wonder at what point they've already had. We're 10 games in. They've already had the players-only meeting, Bob. They've already had it. So you have to wonder how much patience people are going to have in Montreal within the hockey ops department before we see something happen.
Well, and traditionally what happens in this situation is the coach gets fired.
Well, but he's less than a year on the job.
Well, I'm not making the argument that he should. What I said, John, was in this kind of situation, that's how you try and effect change, is by changing your coach. And the Montreal Canadiens have done it. They are not immune to this. They have made coaching changes as well when they've been faced with obstacles and don't have answers. Well, I don't know what the answers are in Montreal.
Let's also remember, Marc Bergevin now is in the last year of his contract, and there has been tons of speculation and discussion in the media, even by Mark when he asked about it at press conferences, about what his future in Montreal is. Why, if he's supposed to be the manager for a long time, why doesn't he have a deal yet? Or is there something to be said for that? And what is Jeffrey Molson, the owner of the team, waiting for? Does there need to be a vote of confidence at that level as well? So there are, and let's face it, I think it's pretty obvious Shea Weber probably will not play another game in his career. He won't retire because he needs to stay on the cap. And obviously the concern about Carey Price, who's now been in the NHLPA, NHL program for, a little more than 3 weeks. He's supposed to be at least 30 days, and that's the minimum amount of time he's supposed to be in the program, whether Carey can come back. But that's asking a lot for one guy to make change like that. And by the way, Carey Price can stop pucks, but he can't score goals. That's their biggest issue.
Well, and worse than that is finding goal scorers is as hard as anything in the National Hockey League. If you think you can make trades, if you've got somebody who can score goals, you're not likely to give them up.
Nope, not right now. Well, and the guys who are supposed to score goals and got good contracts, Tyler Toffoli, Josh Anderson, not scoring enough. We've already mentioned Caulfield has no goals in 10. He was supposed to be, after a great playoff run, he was supposed to be part of the solution. Now you have to wonder is, what do you do with him? Do you send him to the American League, which you can do with him, to get him some confidence back? There's lots of question marks in Montreal.
And no answers right now. We'll take the break. We'll come back and commence the remainder of the program. JP Morosi will join us. The World Series continues, and we'll address it when the program continues after these messages. It's McCowan and Shannon back with you. It is the day after Halloween.
Or after Game 5.
Same thing. And the story is that J.P. Morosi went to his bosses and said, I don't think I can be at Game 6. No, 5 of the World Series, because I bought this new Halloween costume and I want to go trick-or-treating. And they said, oh, well, of course. And so he is back at the home office in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
What the bigger story, Bob, is, and it's all over social media, is that JP did an interview with an Atlanta Brave, and Mr. Soler, in Spanish. And I've never seen anybody roll their R's as perfectly as John Paul Morosi rolled his R's in that interview. Wow. It was, John, I mean, you have a job at the United Nations when you need it.
Well, thanks to you both. And Bob, your story is partially correct. A big thanks to my MLB Network bosses for allowing me to get home to be with the girls on Halloween. I did not myself have much of a costume. That was the one. Oh, that was the only part of the story that was a bit charitable toward my Halloween plan. But yes, I was able to get back, celebrate the holiday with the girls, and I'll be heading back to Houston for game 6. But John, thanks for the kind words. I mean this sincerely. I've had a lot of great teachers over the years in terms of sharing the Spanish language with me. And a lot of them have been baseball players, baseball broadcasters. And it's been a really fun part of the game for me to get it, to have that experience and be able to connect with the players. And it's amazing how they light up when I say, listen, if we can do this slowly, I'll be able to translate and do the best I can with my comprehension. So it's a lot of fun. It's a challenge, but I got to tell you both that the players have been unfailingly patient with me and supportive. And it's probably one of the greatest blessings I've had in the sport is how open they've been to teaching me their language and culture. And, and that was one storybook part of it.
I would imagine, And I don't think you can walk into the clubhouse yet, but I would imagine when Latin players see you on the field, you get a few more smiles from them.
Sure. And you're right, John. And over the years, I've had players come up to me and say that they really appreciate the effort. And, you know, certainly we've all covered sports that have a great international dynamic to them. Hockey is the same way. I'm sure that if you're around players from Russia, from Sweden, from Finland, certainly those from Quebec as well, when you're able to greet them in their native language, it always sends a powerful message. And they remember. I think all of us, if you just sort of put it in your own perspective, if we're traveling overseas and you're going to a new country and there's a person that you see who always will greet you in your native language and make you feel welcome, that's a friendly face that you're always going to remember. And so in those, as you both know, and how eventful and often frenetic those post-game interview scenes can be when you've got 6 or 7 different rights holders there on the field doing interviews and a player knows that you'll be able to hopefully have a really good exchange and conversation in their native language, there's a real comfort there. So I would say this, I'm always comfortable in asking the question in Spanish because I've studied that well and feel comfortable articulating the questions. What I'm often fearful of is making sure that I get the full meaning back and listen to what the speaker is saying next to me and be able to really catch every word and get the full meaning. Because as you both know, you've both done more interviews than I've done in my life. One of the most important things, and Bob has shared this, I've heard Bob say it, and it's so true, about linking together the answer with the next question. Mm-hmm. It's so important, as you both know, to be able to listen, to not worry so much about what a producer might be saying in your ear in the middle of the interview, right? And be able to just be present and listen very intently. So that's kind of that next step to be more comfortable doing that. But it's a lot of fun, John and Bob. And I've learned a lot from both of you in interviewing over the years.
I'm not sure that you guys did or did not hear that alarm go off, but I apologize.
No, we didn't.
You did not?
No.
That's a miracle because it was ringing in my ears. I'm happy to share my entire knowledge of the Spanish language with you. I can do it in one.
Dos cerveza, por favor.
Dos cerveza, por favor, caballero. And I think that's the only Spanish that I'll ever need to know. But, well, this has been such a curious World Series. It hasn't really had a pattern to it. It hasn't had, and maybe all World Series are kind of like that. But I will say this, at the beginning of every single one of these games, I really have no idea who I expect to win. I don't know if you share that assessment or whether you feel this is any different from the many other World Series you've covered in the past, Morosi, but that's sort of how I've taken it. I don't know what's going to happen.
I'm right there with you. I'm appreciating the randomness of it a little bit and appreciating the unpredictability. What I would say is this, to take a step back, if you're an Atlanta Braves fan right now, and if you're looking at the way those middle three games played out in Atlanta, at the outset of that three-game set, let's remember, you knew that you were going to have two bullpen games in a span of three. two bullpen games in a three-game set in the middle of the World Series against the American League champions. Objectively, before game three, if you had told a Braves fan, you're going to win two out of three when you've got two bullpen games in a three-game span against Houston, you would have to be okay with that. You really would. And that's true if you were going to play a three-game series in June against a great team, which is what Houston has. And say you've got two out of the three games are a bullpen game. And if you win that series, that's a good series win. So the Braves won that series at home. They now have Max Fried and Ian Anderson lined up for 6 and 7. So even though the Braves feel disappointed after game five, not having won it at home, you have to be content with the way that it lines up. And on the flip side, now Houston's lineup has woken up. Their bullpen, I think, has the edge. Houston's bullpen has outperformed Atlanta's bullpen, at least recently. And so this is really anybody's series. Houston's playing at home. Their bullpen's lined up. Their lineup got rejuvenated with Atlanta. They have the 3-2 series lead. So both sides, you've got plenty of optimism, depending on how you're looking at it. And I think it's going to be a tremendous final two games. I have to expect that we're going to get a seventh game just based on what Bob is saying and the back and forth nature of the series. But who knows? As I remember, and you can appreciate this, the first time I ever met Bob Cole was before a game seven. I think it was in Pittsburgh, Rangers, Penguins. I remember asking him after the morning skate, I'm meeting Bob Cole for the first time. Like, what do you think we're going to see in game seven? And he basically just looked at me and smiled and said, that's what we're here to find out. And so that was a great line and I've never forgotten it, because don't try to predict these games. Don't try to anticipate, just be there. That's what we're here to find out. So I'm going to, and if anybody asks me in game six, game seven, I'm going to quote the great Bob Cole and leave it at that.
I understand the nature of my question though, really was, in essence, there was a predictability in World Series games in terms of what our anticipation was, not what the result would be.
Right.
But if you had a great pitcher who had 22 wins in the regular season, had a 2.5 ERA against somebody who was, you know, fourth or fifth in the other team's rotation, around 500 with a 4-something ERA, the anticipation would be correct. The team with the better pitcher was going to wind up winning it. In this situation, you got no way to know how anybody is going to pitch. And it raises the question to me, and you may note of this, Atlanta has goes with two bullpen days in three games. Are there general managers out there now scratching their heads and saying, all right, wait a second, is that too much of this? Because the bullpen game 10 years ago was a rarity. Mm-hmm. It's now become common. But can you do too much of it? Or are we about to engage in a scenario where you get 13 bullpen guys, forget starters, who cares?
Hasn't that train left the station already?
Sure. Well, no, it's a great question. To some extent,
but there's a bar, and I wonder if we were going over that bar now.
Right. No, it's a great question, Bob. And John, to your point, it's a very good one as well, that we've in many ways passed this by. A couple things to point out here. The notion of what's happening in baseball now is not necessarily an entirely new one. I had a conversation before the Hall of Fame induction with the great Ted Simmons. Of course, Ted goes into Hall of Fame this year, one of the great catchers ever, and a very thoughtful person. And Ted said, it's a very basic and yet very astute observation on his part, that when you look at the history of baseball in any given year, the batting average for pinch hitters in the National League, let's say, is always appreciably lower than what the average is for the league overall. So the league at baseline, if the batting average is 270, the pinch hitting average might be 220, whatever, because you're often going up against great pitchers late in the game and you're coming off the bench cold and you're facing someone that you haven't faced before in that game. And so Ted basically said, wait a minute, take a step back. If you want to create the maximum advantage for the team that is pitching, how do you do it? Well, you turn every hitter, in theory, into a pinch hitter. You do that by changing the pitcher as often as you possibly can. And that's in theory for one particular game. But as we all know, it's almost impossible to do that out over 162. You're never going to be able to have nine relievers on your roster that all pitch one inning every single day and make 162 appearances. You can't do it. That they would break down. And so there has to be a happy medium. I think to your point, Bob, we're now, and this is something that I know Jason Stark has written about and talked about a lot at The Athletic, and it's a very good point. We're now running into a point where what tends to be effective to win a baseball game on a given day in a given time is not necessarily, and in many cases is not, patently is not, the best way to create drama and connection and feeling and rhythm within a game. We all like and love the game. And when we think about what is a classic ball game to watch, we go back to game 7 of 91, Morris and Smoltz, sure. Game 5 of the 11 division series, Carpenter and Halliday. Those are the games that we romanticize about because we get a chance to watch two great pitchers at their peak back and forth. There's a rhythm and feel to it. Right now, in many of these games, there's very little rhythm. They're exciting, but there isn't that rhythm of a back and forth like a great prize fight between two heavyweights going at it. And I think what we're going to see is a couple things. We may see in the next CBA some different incentives to build a club in different fashions. I mean, that's one of the parts of why teams are built this way is because financially, in many cases, it's made sense. But also, let's not forget, the prevalence of injuries to pitchers is inherently part of the reason that the teams are building their rotations this way. Let's be clear. If Mike Soroka from Calgary was healthy, and if Charlie Morton hadn't been hit with a line drive in the first game of the series, the Braves would not have had a bullpen game in either game 4 or game 5, because the rotation would have been Morton, Soroka, then Fried, then Anderson. Or they would have had four starting pitchers. But the prevalence of injuries has made a necessity out of this reengineering of pitching, and that's what's happened, Bob.
All right. You know, let's take that. Let me take that to a next step and relate it to the Toronto Blue Jays, just because you've got two significant starters in Ray and Mats, who are free agents.
Mm-hmm.
Do you deal differently with them? Is their relevance and importance to the Toronto Blue Jays less because of the way the game is being played today? And, you know, we would say that Robbie Ray, Cy Young or not, is going to make $20 million. I think we would all agree on that. Somebody's going to pay him 20, maybe a bit more than 20. Is he worth that, though? Is he worth that in the scenario that has unfolded where you could, as I said, you could get 12, 14 bullpen guys and just play with that. And I understand the negatives that you're throwing out, but like, where's the bar? Where is the balance between starting pitching and bullpen days? And how does it affect Ray and
Matt? It's a great question. One that I'm sure the Blue Jays front office is working through right now.
Well, what do you think though?
Here's what I think. You look at years ago, when the Tampa Bay Rays pioneered this concept of the opener, and there was all this fascination with the idea of Ryan Stanek, who ironically is now pitching in the bullpen for Houston, was the original opener, if you will.
Right.
The reason that plan worked and the reason why the opener eventually was effective for Tampa is because they had Blake Snell winning 20 games that year. You can be creative and mix around one starter here and there and finesse them and put in an opener. If you know that 3 out of the 5 days in that cycle, you're getting a legit deep start from a quality starting pitcher. Ross Stripling, if you think about how the Jays used him this past year, he was able to be utilized by and large in good and effective methods because they had Robbie Ray pitching at a Cy Young level on other days. If there's no Robbie Ray, the whole pitching paradigm in this team would have collapsed by July. You need a couple guys. And this is where, because, again, of the variable health of so many pitchers, if you believe strongly that these two or three starters are going to really carry the water for you all season long. They're going to make 30 starts, or at least 27 of them. They're going to give you 170 or 180 or more quality innings. If you build your rotation around those three guys, you had better be right. Because if you plan correctly and you get the right performance from them, they will probably help you build a playoff candidacy, which is why the way that the Jays season played out this year was I realized they missed the playoffs, but it was incredibly successful, incredibly sound. I would try to bring back Steven Matz for another year because quality starting innings are hard to find. And let's not forget, for fans that are watching and listening in Toronto, or those that maybe in the lower mainland who maybe were rooting for Seattle, let's remember this. Both the Blue Jays and the Mariners won more games this year than the Atlanta Braves. Think about that for a moment.
Oh yeah,
the Jays and the Mariners both won more games than the team that might well win the World Series.
So a couple of things. I want to go back a little bit. You talked about the days of Schmaltz versus Morris and the bullpen world that we see now. The difference there was, and I was at that World Series game. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was more than 2 hours and 50 minutes. And last night, John, was 4 hours with all the changes. And I know we have longer commercial breaks because of the money they're paying, but baseball's too long. Baseball's arduous right now. That was a great baseball game last night, particularly the first five innings. It was a circus. Sure. But I can tell you what, the NFL game that started at the same time was over by the top of the eighth inning. The Seattle Kraken game started an hour after and ended at the top of the eighth inning. Mm-hmm. Baseball's too long right now. And that's
they've recognized it, John.
That's the issue with all these bullpen guys.
Well, I think the real question here is at some point, the management of baseball teams and the executives of Major League Baseball have to get together, because you've got one side saying our games are too long. We got to find ways to speed it up. And then they turn around and, you know, they evolutionize the way pitchers are used. And now you got bullpen guys coming in 5, 6, 7, 8 guys.
Yeah.
They're inconsistent with each other. Morosi?
Correct. Well, I think a couple of things there, and you're both making very good points. There is a definite sense in the game that something does need to change. And yet there is a vast divergence of opinion as to how that can be achieved. And individual team executives might say, yeah, we realize that the way the game is played right now is not the best from a standpoint of entertainment, because the ball is not in play as often as it was 10, 20 years ago. And yet at the end of the day, your job is to win. And so,
okay, let me just interrupt you there, because I think there's something even more fundamental. How old are you now?
I am almost 40, John. Okay. I'm almost 40 years old.
And your love of the game occurred when?
When I was a kid, in the 80s and 90s.
Okay, so the I'll tell you what, when you were 10 years old and game 5 of the World Series ended at midnight, I guarantee you didn't watch it.
That's right.
And that's a problem. I mean, the Atlanta Braves could have won the World Series last night. And every fan of the Braves that was a kid at 10 years old would not have been able to see the trophy presentation.
Yeah, right? But that's your business's problem. That's television.
No, but that's hey.
At least in part.
I agree with you, but that's symptomatic of the whole system, Bob.
Well,
there's nothing. I mean, a Sunday night 6 o'clock start makes sense to me, but that's another story. I just can't believe it. To me, this is something that Rob Manfred, who says he has the best interest in the game, and the networks. I'm concerned about the next generation. I'm concerned about the next generation loving the game like the three of us do.
It's, and there are fair concerns, John and Bob. I think that it's interesting to me, though, that as we talk about how young fans consume the game, it is fundamentally different than the way that we grew up with it. Back when we were growing up in different ways, the idea was you watch the game, you gathered around the TV, and that was how you fell in love with the sport.
Bob listened on his Heathkit. Bob listened on his Heathkit.
But I'll say this. Now, loving the game and what a 15, 16-year-old wants to do to fall in love with the game is, did you see this highlight from last night? Can I share this on social media? Did I experience this with my friends and text them about it? Or was there other forms of, we hear a lot about TikTok and other different social media apps. That is how young people, in by and large, connect and fall in love with the sport. It's appreciated differently. I also think on some level, because of the prevalence of travel ball and the way that the game is nurtured at the young levels here in the US, especially, kids spend so much time playing the game all year round that I think they might be more involved in their own 12-month a year development as opposed to watching the game in a ritual like we would have done when we were kids. It's a different method where it's the notion of time spent watching the sport for hours on end and sitting down and really surrounding yourself with a World Series game versus is your experience with the game, travel ball training, winter training, indoors, whatever it might be, 12 months out of the year. And that's how you love the game. While the narrative is what it is about viewership in the US, the reality is youth baseball is still one of the most popular sports in the US. It's just perhaps in different ways than what we normally saw it in Little League traditionally in generations gone by.
We got to take a break. We'll come back. We'll chat some more. JP Morosi is with us. Back after these messages. McCowan, Shannon, Morosi, just chatting in general about baseball in the midst of the World Series. And we were talking about length of games, time of games, kids being able to stay up late enough to watch the end of games. And we can all remember being kids and asking our parents, you know, can I stay up? Can I stay up? And if it was a special event, sometimes they said yes. But a lot of times they said, no, you got to go to school tomorrow, so you got to go to bed. At the end of this, there are two factors in my mind. And we've addressed both of them. Number one, we have become used to baseball games starting at 7:07. I don't even know, John, in most markets.
Probably.
You have 7 o'clock starts or, you know, a few minutes after seven. Why a World Series game can't start at 7:07 is beyond me. I know why it is. It's network television and they want it, you know, they want prime time and this, that, and the other thing.
Prime time in all three time zones.
Yeah, well, too bad. That don't work under any circumstance. So 7:07 starts, and then we got to figure out ways to shorten the length of games. And if you're going to parade 12 or 13 or 15 pitchers into a game, let me throw one thing at you. How many warm-up pitches does a pitcher get when he comes into a game from the mound? 8?
It depends on time.
Why does it need any? These are major league pitchers who understand mounds are essentially the same. Essentially. I know there are subtle differences. It's not the end of the world. I say you bring in a pitcher. If you have to, let him throw one pitch. One.
Think from a health standpoint,
go ahead.
You need more time. I think from a health standpoint, you need more time. I think sure that your arm is ready to go.
You got all day in the bullpen. If you're not ready in the bullpen, you're not going to get ready on the mound with 8 more pitches.
But here's the thing and this feeds into the other part of the conversation, the velocity. It takes pitchers now, especially when they're throwing in the upper 90s, many of them, it takes a little bit more time to get an arm that's throwing. We think about this intuitively. If you're going to throw a ball 100 miles an hour, not that I know what that feels like, but if you're going to do that, your arm really has to be stretched out and ready to go, much more so than if you're throwing a ball 50 miles an hour.
Get ready in the bullpen. That's why you pitch there.
But Bob, the point, and I'll say this, the time in between innings, if there's an issue with it, it has to do with the commercial break and the length of the commercial break, and oh, not it has nothing to do with the pitchers. And trust me,
JP, you're misreading me. Like when a guy at the start of an inning, let him have his warm-up pitches. I'm talking about a guy coming in from the bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
Just we're going to make a pitching change. I want the right-hander. He comes in and he gets 8 pitches from the mound after he's warmed up in the bullpen. And the, and we all sit there with our arms full.
Well,
you know,
well, there is a
why?
As you know, Bob, there is a commercial break while he is warming up.
Get rid of the commercial break then.
Well,
all you got to do is fire a couple of TV guys and that takes
we got to pay the bills there, Bob. We got to pay the bills.
Oh, they got to make money. It's not so paying
there's
the bills.
There's a commercial break as part of it. It's become part of the ritual, both from a TV viewership standpoint and the warm-up standpoint for the pitcher. I'll say a couple of quick things. In general, I have been very impressed by the efficiency with which pitchers do warm up. I am a big supporter of there is now a clock that as soon as the pitcher arrives at the mound, they have a certain allotted time to get all the warm-ups in, and then you start the game. So I think that in general, the MLB has trimmed a lot of the dead time out of the sport. The issue that is fundamental that Bob, I think that you're alluding to in terms of the time of the game has to do with the velocity of the pitching, missing bats. There used to be an entire idea, if you go back to the 80s and 90s, oriented around the ball being put in play. Either pitchers pitched to contact or hitters valued contact. What is happening now is you hear hitters talking about getting their A swing all the time, which means swinging for extra bases no matter what the circumstance is, and they're doing it against pitching that is increasingly hard to hit, with the velocity being as high as it is, the sharpness of the breaking ball being as sharp as it is. That's what's happened here, is the sport has evolved in a way that contact is harder to achieve. And this is what is taking counts deeper, more strikeouts. This is the essential dynamic of watching a baseball game now, is a relatively small percentage of balls in play. It's gotten a little bit better this year with the enforcement of the sticky stuff. Mm-hmm. But in general, we are at a spot where, because of a lot of evolutionary forces, the game is centered on less and less contact relative to what it was even 10 years ago.
But just to go back to the original intent of the question, do you think baseball thinks the games are too long?
Yes, I do. Yeah. And I think baseball has worked on different remedies for it. And that even includes the enforcement of the sticky stuff during the course of the year, taking that out of the game as much as possible, and finding ways to enhance and incentivize more balls in play. But the essential training regimen of the game, decisions made by teams. If you have someone that throws 99 and someone that throws 89, you're going to take the guy that throws 99 almost every single time. And that decision is replicated by amateur scouts who are selecting guys for the draft. It's replicated by college coaches who recruit. Mm-hmm. It's replicated by high school coaches and travel ball coaches. The prioritization on velocity is what is guiding a lot of the decisions and the way the game is played out in front of us. And I've said this, if at some point in time, if we as an industry are truly alarmed by the number of strikeouts and the lower percentage of balls in play, then do we start every count at 1-1? Do we do something that dramatic to incentivize more balls in play? It might be that we have to take that step, because the rest of these other fixes and solutions are not necessarily transformative. The no pitch intentional walk, modest change to the time of game. If you really want to fundamentally alter the pace of baseball, you may have to go with a 1-1 count universally and make that the way to entice more balls in play.
Well, and video review hasn't helped. Now, the good news is we haven't had that many video reviews in the World Series, but
right. Video
review doesn't help.
I think in general, replay has helped. It has made the game better, and it's not too obtrusive from my perspective to where we are having an inordinate amount of replay review. We have some. We have just about the right amount from my perspective.
We got to get out of here. Time is our enemy, but two games left maximum in this World Series. Do you expect Atlanta to win? I mean, they're up. They have folded in the past with a 3-1 lead. We actually talked about it with the Dodgers series.
Right.
The possibility of that happening. They got to 3-2 and then Atlanta pulled it out. You expect them to win game six?
I believe that Atlanta will win in seven at this point, because I believe Houston finds a way to force a seventh game at home. And then once they get there, I like Ian Anderson against whatever Houston's going to be able to have. So that's, I believe by the end of the series, the Braves structure, their rotation is now in a better place with Fried and Anderson. I believe Atlanta prevails in seven games.
So that means Alex Anthopoulos wins the World Series because he had a better trade deadline than
he had the best trade deadline. And of course, we'll see Freddie Freeman, as you both know, a dual citizen, a proud son of two Ontarians, will win the World Series as well.
Well, that's very Canadian of you.
Hey, I'm a neighbor, Bob. This is it's all in our neighborhood, and we can
cross the border and visit him soon too.
That's exactly right.
Well, there's no chance of that happening.
Come on over to Ann Arbor. We got the most closely watched. I'm not going to talk football, Bob. We got the most closely watched hockey team outside the NHL is right here in this town.
Yeah.
And by the way, if you've not seen it yet, Kent Johnson, the goal he scored between his legs, he could win the Hobie Baker. And by the way, he's going to be one of the great players for Team Canada at the World Juniors, along with Owen Power. But Kent Johnson's goal, if you haven't seen it yet, do yourself a favor. Between the legs, top shelf.
His skill level.
He is Elias Pettersson in college hockey right now. He's got hands that good.
And a Columbus draft pick.
So. That's right. Fifth overall.
Well, I was going to say, I don't care what anybody in blue and gold wears, but he was a Columbus. He's a Columbus.
Exactly, Bob.
Well, I mean,
Kent Johnson unites us all.
So now, all right, I'm moderately
unites us all.
By the way, where's the game this year? I can't keep track. Is it at your joint or ours?
It's in Ann Arbor. So come on over for that, too. We have to structure a whole weekend. Come on over. It'd be great.
Be great for me. It'll be another sad day for you.
Oh, man. I'm not sure I can take the traffic at the big house.
So. All right. Well, just keep thinking about it. And if you guys want to come over, you got a spot to stay. All good.
We got to go. See you, pal.
All the best. Thanks, guys.
John Paul Morosi, come back after these messages. McCown and Shannon back with you. And our thanks to our pal, JP Morosi.
I think we should plan on the trip, Bob. I really, really do.
I'd be more inclined to, if I have to spend time with Morosi, I'd rather it was at the Horseshoe than up in Ann Arbor, to tell you the truth.
No, but you see, the great thing about Morosi,
I don't trust those Michiganders, you know.
No, but the great thing about Morosi is that we don't have to drive back into Detroit. We can just stay in Ann Arbor. We can just stay there. Maybe we could walk to the house.
Why would we want to go back to Detroit? What's the relevance of that?
You have to go to Detroit to get across the border, Bob.
Well, you don't have to, but you would. I mean, that would be the logical way.
What would you do? You drive to Ohio?
No, you go to Port Huron and then come down. You could go that way. There's other ways to get across the border.
Okay.
Just saying.
I just want to avoid the traffic, Bob. Stay in Ann Arbor. You don't have to go too far, you know?
But then I'd be surrounded by Michigan fans. And
yeah, but if you won, Bob, then you could actually you could flaunt it and enjoy it.
Oh, no, you can't.
Oh, what do you mean?
Because they'll beat the crap out of you.
I don't think so. University sports is very civilized.
Sure it is. kind of like European soccer. Very civilized. Oh. You know, you win some, you lose some. Everybody has a bottle of beer with together after the game. Oh, yeah, congratulations.
Hey, we go to the pub. We'll just go to the pub and have a pint.
They kick the crap out of each other.
Now, is there an Ohio State fight song? Do you know the Ohio State fight song?
Well, there is an Ohio State fight song, but I'm not going to sing it. You know, I know it, but I'm not going to sing it.
What is it?
Well, I'm not going into that.
Why?
There's a fight. Every university has a song. Not just Michigan or Notre Dame. Every university has a song. Obviously, the schools that are on television the most are when you hear that song, you understand. Like, I don't know what Alabama's fight song is, but they have
it's got to be Roll Tide, something Roll Tide.
Well, yeah, but but I don't know I don't know what it sounds like. And I've actually been there to Tuscaloosa for a game.
Now, as a child, you were always a Buckeye fan. So as a kid, you watched the Buckeyes and you know, Rex.
Well, yeah, because I was born in Columbus, Ohio. Yeah,
I know that, but you were in Toronto. And so, but you were watching the
Rose Bowl. But I was aware.
You were watching the Rose Bowl and Woody Hayes. So was it your goal always to be the tuba player and dot the I in the script?
No, it was to be the quarterback. Oh. Forget the tuba player.
I don't know. The tuba player and dot in the I at the script was pretty cool.
I wasn't big enough, fat enough to be a tuba player.
I don't know. You were a goalie. Goalie.
But I was perfect to be the star quarterback.
Did you used to do the Heisman pose too? Oh, there it is right there. Okay.
Right there, baby. Where's my football? in the midst of moving.
I'm sorry I asked.
Well, see, there's the running back one where you have the ball here, right? And then there's the quarterback one, which
as I said.
And I were kids, and for all you youngins,
football cards.
Every football card, you could tell what position the guy played without even looking at the notation on the card.
Wow.
If it was this, he was the quarterback. If it was this, he was the running back.
And then you had guys.
And if he was this, he was a lineman.
Then if you had guys like Paul Hornung that really screwed it up for you, because he could do everything.
He could do both. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, we got to get out of here. I know we had other things to talk about, but we don't have time for them now.
No.
Because we got into nonsensical conversations, which is pretty predictable in this program. You want to tell the audience who's on tomorrow? Or you want to leave them in suspense? I mean, after all, they were in suspense last night with Halloween.
No, we don't know yet.
All right. Oh, we don't know.
No.
Okay. Well, whoever is here, beware. That's all I have to say. Until tomorrow, for John Shannon, Bob McCowan, thanks for watching or listening, as the case may be. See ya.